Often when I'm giving Dharma talks, I speak in terms of weather systems. You know, the outside weather has been kind of this exceptional, beautiful, very conducive. And also the awareness that we've now had a couple of days. And for many people, you just start noticing it just keeps changing in there. And maybe moments of really feeling, arrived, a kind of peace or settled or really noticing. And then other times just really carried off into small-mindedness or judgment or tightness or fear. And I know that when it's unpleasant, this is the basic law, when it's unpleasant, we don't like it and we want it to go away. And sometimes what that means is we want to go away. We want to exit. And I always say at the beginning, it probably runs through at least, 90% of the minds of, what am I doing here? Or how can I get out of here? How can I make it 5 more days or whatever? And I'll share with you something I got some months ago. It's a postcard. On the front, it says, deep Zen-like meditation at the push of a button. Try it free. Meditate like a Zen monk right at the push of a button. Remarkable, fantastic. You can evolve and become enlightened just by pushing this button. And it goes on to describe this audio system that, in a very short time will give you inner peace and freedom. So I'm going to leave this up here by the checkbook. But, it's sometimes we wonder if there's an easier way, or what is the way, or does this work? Whenever we're stuck, whenever we're in a reactive place, we'll notice there's a feeling of selfness. There's like a me in here having trouble. And the more stuck we are, the more we're kind of resisting and not liking it, the more solid and substantial that selfness, that meanness is. And if we deepen our attention, we'll find that the undercurrent is fear. There's some sort of a clutch, and it's fear. It's said that the primal mood of the separate self is fear. That when we're in that reactivity, that selfness, there's always fear. Even when we're not in a great amount of emotional reactivity, if we're moving through the day in this kind of orbit of a self, getting through a retreat or trying to do this or that, there's some dukkha or tension which has got a undertone of fear. So, in a sense, any awakening on the spiritual path involves a willingness to get to know and be with and open to fear. There's no way around it. And just to say that fear is the anticipatory tensing against what might go wrong. That in any organism, the most simple to the most complex, there's an apprehension of what might go wrong and a tensing. And that tensing is a form of trying to control, trying to protect from the bad thing happening. Okay, so I'll share with you an article I read that I thought really described this well. And it's one monk describing a fellow monk who, he says, a member of our monastery has very bad teeth. He's needed to have many teeth pulled out, but he'd rather not have the anesthetic. So eventually he found a dental surgeon in Perth who was willing to extract his teeth without an anesthetic. So he's done that many times. He doesn't find that a problem. But then he did one better. He decided to pull out his own tooth without an anesthetic. So we saw him outside the monastery workshop holding a freshly pulled tooth smeared with blood in the claws of an ordinary pair of pliers. It was no problem. He cleaned the pliers of the blood before he returned them to the workshop. I asked him how he had managed to do such a thing. And here's what he said. He said, when I decided to pull out my own tooth, it was such a hassle going all the way to the dentist. That didn't hurt. When I walked to the workshop, that didn't hurt. When I picked up the pair of pliers, that didn't hurt. When I held the tooth in the grip of the pliers, that also didn't hurt. When I wiggled the pliers and pulled, it did hurt then, but only for a couple of seconds. Once the tooth was out, it didn't hurt much at all. That was only 5 seconds of pain. And then he goes on to say, you, my reader, probably grimaced when you read this true story. Because of fear, you probably felt more pain than he did. And if you tried the same feat, it would probably hurt terribly, even before you reached the workshop to get the pliers. Anticipation, fear, is the major ingredient of pain. It's right now such a resonant thing for me whenever there's physical sickness. It's not the immediate discomfort of sickness. That's not the suffering. We always are adding something on, which is a story about how this pain will never end, what it means about us, what it means about how the rest of our life will be, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain. The grief, the fear, the sadness, that itself, it's experience of weather. But we add on, it'll never end, I can't handle it. Around the corner, something's going to be too much. So that's the thing to explore. Ultimately, we're tensing against, the real anticipation is our own mortality. There's the sense of the demise of these temporary lives, and we're tensing against it. And the sad truth, and this is really the center of the Dharma, is our very resisting against fighting impermanence, our very effort to control our experience, to preserve this self, is the activity that deprives us of living fully. And it's the activity that deprives us of really loving without holding back. Because if we're tensing against what's next, we can't be here. So that's what I want to explore tonight. I want to explore the trance of fear. You know, what does it mean to get caught in fear? And really, what is our true refuge? In other words, what's really a liberating way to be with fear so that it serves awakening and it doesn't kind of perpetuate the sense of a separate self running, defending, protecting. So a poem for you to maybe create the atmosphere is Rumi. Be empty of worrying. Think of who created thought. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Move outside the tangle of fear thinking. Live in silence. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. So as we explore, when we just kind of reflect on this poem, and you know, one key piece is really to wake up out of the tangle of fear thinking. And that's a lot of our practice, is just to recognize, oh, lost in thought, lost in the trance, wake up. And then flow down and down. I love that expression. It's a real surrendering. It's a letting go of all control and just letting go into the life that's here and letting go into widening rings of being. In other words, letting go into the vastness that we are. So to begin with, fear is absolutely natural and necessary. One of the big misunderstandings that we have is fear comes up, and I can say this for myself, a wave of fear will come, and even though I'll say, okay, I'm going to be with this, breathe with this, there's still some undercurrent of this shouldn't be here, and this shouldn't be happening. We think there's a mistake, like something's going wrong when there's fear. And so just to say that it's part of our physiological, psychological wiring, and it's absolutely essential for survival. If we didn't have fear, we'd be brain dead. You know, we wouldn't be able to survive. And it allows us to apprehend danger, real danger, and to do fight or flight in times that we really need to. And it's for humans, a lot of our thinking is fear-based. Some of it's valuable. Some of it, we need to strategize. We need to plan. We need to organize ourselves. I have a favorite illustrative story that's kind of specific to Seven Oaks. Some of you might have been here at the retreat where we had a little encounter with a bear. And a woman that was down in the sanctuary, she left her shoes outside and she was meditating. And when she got out, one of the shoes was missing. About 5 yards away, this bear was slathering all over it. It was, anyway, so I shared this then and I'll share it now. In Colorado, Department of Fish and Wildlife is advising hikers, hunters, fishers, golfers to take extra precautions and keep alert for bears. They advise people to wear noise-producing devices such as little bells on their clothing to alert but not startle the bears unexpectedly. They also advise carrying a pepper spray in case of an encounter with a bear. It's also good to watch for fresh signs of bear activity. People should recognize the difference between black bears, that's what's here, and grizzly bear droppings. Black bear droppings are smaller and contain berries and possible squirrel fur. Grizzly bear droppings have little bells in them and smell like pepper spray. So the best laid plans, right? We have this capacity to strategize and in some ways to avoid danger appropriately. And we also know that the tangle of fear thinking is frequently overthinking, that it just keeps churning and it doesn't have the wisdom of enough already, you know. It just keeps on spinning on and on and on. One of my favorite one-liners is of when a woman, it's a Jewish mom, sending her son a telegram and it says, "Start worrying, details to follow," you know. Get ready, here comes, you know. And Mark Twain, who writes that, as many of you remember, the worst things in my life never actually happened. So there's this propensity of the mind to just churn on and on with fear thinking. So when does fear, this natural, you know, part of our rigging, become suffering? You know, how the Buddha, in Buddhist parlance, it said that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Fear is inevitable, but the suffering of fear is optional. When we suffer with fear, it's because we're in what I call a trance of fear, which means that our reality, our sense of truth, of wholeness, has contracted and our sense of our being has become identified with the fear. It's taken over. It's like the shape of our reality is the shape of fear. So rather than it being a current in the ocean, it becomes all of what we are. We've contracted. And what keeps the contraction going is all our strategies for trying to control the fear. In other words, we become the shape of the fear and then all the thoughts and actions and body tightening becomes part of this identity. We become that. It all comes down to, in the deepest way, a sense of separation. Really, the pain that we live in is a sense of separateness. And the more aggravated that sense of separateness, the more fear. So some people have a biochemistry that inclines them towards fear. And then the trance gets, you know, then that gets compounded in personal life when that fear gets played out and there's rejection and distance, and then it becomes more and more the sense of identity. For some, there was really physical lack of safety. And that set in motion a biochemistry that then set in motion thoughts that then creates more physicality of fear. It's called nama-rupa, body-mind. Our thoughts create a sense of our chemistry. Our chemistry keeps producing the thoughts. And on we go. And then our sense of who we are becomes that. For most of us, our fear is psychological. For most of us, it's not physical safety. It's psychological and it has to do with the fear of being unloved. If you have to ask, you know, what is it a child most wants? It's to be seen truly for what we are, and to be loved for that. And that in this culture and our parents, no matter how well-meaning, the trance of the culture is such that most of us had some deficits in that. And so there was an unsafe feeling around being loved, being seen. That's the core fear that we live with. And then, of course, it gets, in a daily way, it's infused with the whole experience of each day, I'm falling short in some way. How are they going to perceive me? What's wrong with me? How am I going to fail? There's that undercurrent of anxiety because of this core, what I call kind of severed belonging, not really being seen truly, not being loved well. For many of us, it fixates on performance. A lot of us, because in some way we've been kind of conditioned to feel like if only we do it well enough, then we can solve that problem. So what we do with this kind of core wound, the sense of separation and the fear that comes, is we all take what I call false refuge. And each of us has our set of strategies to try to deal with that clutch, that sense of not okayness. We all have our strategies. And they fall in, and they're all ways of trying to control our experience, trying to get away from the fear, trying to make it all okay. And they come under freeze, flight, and fight, as you know. But it's really helpful just to reflect for a moment and sense, so what are your ways, you know, in a daily way of trying to move away from this kind of unease, this clutch of a self that's uneasy about a self? So one major strategy is that many people use is numbing with substances. We try to kind of in some way get away from the feeling, numbing or altering our biochemistry, whether it's with food or drugs. For many, I use caffeine because in some way if I take caffeine, then I speed up, then I do more, and performing might end up having me be, you know, it kind of soothes the sense of not okayness. There's a wonderful picture I saw at one conference where you had two men sitting on a park bench, really shabby, homeless, etc. And one saying, well, I used to be CEO of a major corporation and own my own jet and vacation homes in Aspen and so on. And then I switched to decaf, you know. And that set it off for me. So that's one big way, is that we use chemicals and other things to try to either numb or change our state. Another is that we chronically do. We're very uncomfortable with being because our doing is our way of controlling. If we can just do something, we can control the situation and get away from fear. I think it was William James who says we live in this ceaseless frenzy. This was like 100 and some years ago, where we're always feeling like there's something else we should be doing. So that's a false refuge. The speed of our culture is a false refuge. We think, you know, if we feel anxious, we speed up, we go online. Will anything's okay other than not doing when there's trouble? Somebody sent me this about a year ago. A couple of New Jersey hunters are out in the woods, and one of them's horrified because the other falls to the ground. He doesn't seem to be breathing. His eyes are rolled back in his head. Totally freaked out, terrified. He whips out his cell phone, calls emergency services, gasps to the operator, my friend is dead. What can I do? The operator, in a calm, soothing voice, says, just take it easy. I can help. First, let's make sure he's dead. There's a silence, and then a shot is heard. The guy's voice comes back on the line. He says, okay, now what? You know? I apologize for that one, but there's a Tom Wolfe has a beautiful story about these pilots, the test pilots back in the 50s that were testing these planes at heights where aerodynamics no longer worked, and they were crashing and crashing and crashing. And what they heard on the radio that the pilots would be saying is, I've tried this, I've tried this, I've tried this, I've tried this, what can I do next? And there was only one pilot that made it of many of them, and what happened was he got knocked unconscious for a bit, and then the plane just was able to get through the insanity of the higher altitudes, and then he was able to land it. And as it turned out, the answer to the problem was you take your hands off the controls. That's what Tom Wolfe, he wrote in his book. He said that was the answer to the problem, is that the more they were juggling the controls, the worse the situation. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. What turns it into suffering is this effort to control it, to make it go away, to run away, to fix. I think one of the biggest things that we find at retreat, because retreat is such an incredible light, it shines so much on our habits of running away, because there's not so many ways out, is how much we're figuring out things. You ever notice just how much time we spend trying to figure out something? This is the mind trying to control experience. Fear and control are synonymous. When there's a selfing around fear, there's a controlling going on. The body's tensing. The mind speeds up and tries to figure things out. Often our refuge when there's a lot of fear is to blame somebody. And James talked about this beautifully last night, just the comparing mind. Something's wrong, it's wrong with you. Or something's wrong, that's the fear feeling, it's wrong with me. So I would say our fundamental strategy that keeps fueling fear is we add this extra layer. In other words, there's the sensations and feelings, and then we add something's wrong, either with me or with you. In some way, you know, when I do workshops on radical acceptance and I ask the question, well, what would really happen if you put down all stories of something's wrong with me? What if you really didn't believe them? And what if there's really acceptance of life just as it is? And the response is, I'm afraid to accept life just as it is. I'm afraid to love myself or accept myself because I'll never improve. I'll never get better. In fact, I'll keep doing the bad things and then no one will love me and then I'll be more separate and more scared. So we have some belief, this is the small self-belief, that it's by controlling ourselves into better selfhood that then we'll be loved and okay. Does that make sense? I mean, it doesn't make sense deep down, but... So Carl Rogers, a wonderful psychologist, one of his deepest realizations was it wasn't until I accepted myself, my life, just as I was, that I was free to change. In other words, the not accepting, the blaming, keeps fueling the fear and fueling the behaviors that we actually are stuck in. That not resisting how it is, that opening to how it is actually the precondition to change. So let's explore then here what it is that really allows fear when it arises to serve awakening. What lets it serve awakening and freedom? So the question is really, what's our true refuge? And in a way, I think of it as how do we... that when we're afraid, the self gets armored and armed, controlling. How do we disarm? Because again, if fear is to serve awakening, it's not because we add another doing. We don't have some clever manipulation that then makes it work. That's more selfing. So how do we disarm? And the secret really, in every whatever difficult emotion we're working with, is what we resist persists. If there's any resisting or controlling, if we keep running more stories, it persists. It reinforces a basic sense of a threatened self. So I'd like to share a story of Ajahn Chah, great Thai master and teacher for many of the kind of the lineage that many of the Western teachers come from, including Jack Kornfield and Ajahn Sumedho that James talked about last night. And this is a story that was told by Ajahn Amaro about Ajahn Chah dealing with fear. And I find it really telling. So Ajahn Chah had a terror of ghosts, a fear of corpses. And by the way, that's very common in that culture. In Thailand, the fear of ghosts is, and the prospect of encountering them is really terrifying. So he decided he wanted to confront this fear, because even as he was recognized as one of the great meditation masters in Thailand, he still had this fear of ghosts. So he decided to confront it, and the way he did it was he went to these burning grounds right outside the village he was visiting, because they have these cremation grounds outside of many villages, and or most, I guess, and he camped there. And during that time, there were a couple of funerals and a couple of cremations. And the first evening at dusk when it was happening, his mind was screaming, "Don't be ridiculous. Don't do this. It's not good for your samadhi. Be reasonable. Maybe you can do this later. Maybe next year when your practice is a little more together." So, okay, this is postponing, rationalizing. Not now. Just wait a little. You'll have a stronger practice. We know that one. Just. So he willed himself to stay. And it might not seem like a big deal to us, but it was to him. I mean, some of you might remember 1984, where there was room 101, where each of us would meet our most horrifying fear, the visceral fear that for us was like completely grabbed us. This was his room 101. Okay, so he stayed. And the second night he was there, at midnight, the footsteps got louder. He heard like footsteps coming towards him. And there he was camping and feeling these footsteps. And he closed his eyes and he felt the fear rising up. He says in his mind's eye he could see the charred body walking towards him. He could see a skeleton with guts hanging out, with the scored bits of flesh hanging off. And he felt this rank mess of flesh walking towards him. He told himself, "Don't believe it. This is just your imagination. Stop. Be still. Concentrate. Let go of the fear." In the meantime, the footsteps were getting closer and closer. Then he heard the steps going around and around him, thump, 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 circling around again and again. By this time, he was in a state of white hot fear. He had gone beyond anxiety. His body was locked, solid, and sweating bullets. He was absolutely rigid. Then this presence came and stood right in front of him. Ajahn Chah was still determined to keep his eyes closed, not even a peek. At this point, he was so completely fear-stricken, it burst. The fear system was going at absolutely full force when suddenly he had the remembering. "All these years I've been reciting, this body is impermanent. Feeling is impermanent. Perceptions are impermanent. The body is not self. Feelings are not self. Perceptions are not self. Mental formations are not self. Consciousness is not self." These are the aggregates that James was talking about last night. So he wasn't just afraid. He was also very concentrated and very alert. He was fully present. This is what's happening. It's not self. The insight flashed into his consciousness. Even if this is some terrible, ghoulish monster that is going to attack me, all that it can attack is that which is not me. All that it can harm is the body, the feelings, the perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. That is the only stuff that can get damaged, and that's not me. That's not self. That which knows all of these cannot be touched. And instantly the feelings of terror evaporated. It was like switching on a light. It disappeared completely, and he went into an incredibly blissful state. He went straight from total dukkha, pain and fear, to extraordinary bliss. His mind was alert, and as that happened, he heard the footsteps, thump, 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 getting fainter. Eventually, the footsteps disappeared. He never found out their source. Ajahn Chah sat there without moving until dawn. During the night, it poured. Tears of rapture ran down his face and mixed with the rain. Nothing in the world could have moved him. Comparing that experience of freedom from fear with the abject terror of the first half of the night burnt into him the fact that the Buddha is our true refuge. The Buddha mind is our refuge. Remembering the awareness that is our true home is the refuge. So I'd like to take this story apart to and kind of just look at some component pieces, and really two pieces. And one is what I call learning to stay. And that means really just with that same, he had this willingness because he really wanted to be free and knew that he could have gotten away with still being, you know, a great respected teacher, but internally he wasn't free if there was something that he was running from. So learning to stay, being willing to really feel and be with what's there. And the second part is refuge and awareness. Like, how do we really take refuge in truth? How do we remember what we're forgetting? Okay? So one, you might consider one is refuge in the Dharma, in the actual waves of experience. Having the clarity and openness to be right here with the waves of experience. And then the refuge in the Buddha is really, how do we remember the awareness, which sometimes is so obscured when we're contracted? Okay. I think of refuge in the Dharma as a deepening spiral of recognizing and allowing experience. And that we can sit here and have an initial experience of kind of arriving and noticing, feeling a physical discomfort, maybe, kind of tightness in the shoulders and allowing it some. Or we can even say, fear, naming it and making some room. Then it can drop deeper and deeper so that the recognition is really sensing what that clutch is like. And in a very profound way, not resisting. So there's not even this idea of a self that's making room. There's absolutely letting be. So it spirals deeper and deeper as our practice deepens. We start exactly where we are in taking refuge in the Dharma when fear arises. And what that means is, it's like you might sense, well, where I am is I'm kind of feeling it as underneath there, but there's a numbness. Or where we are might be, I'm just feeling irritation. It might have many presentations. It might be just a really anxious thoughts, but no sense of the body at all. So we begin recognizing, if there's a lot of thoughts, you might ask, and we talked about this earlier in one of our groups, what am I believing? You know, what is it really that I'm believing right now? If there's feelings going on, squeezed, ache, sore, unpleasant, or maybe emotions, depressed, angry, ashamed. Or we might notice the behaviors, restless, or moving, oversleeping, eating. So we begin by recognizing, how does this basic body of fear present itself in this moment? And when I say body of fear, I mean all the different layers of it. A very helpful description that I ran into, Joko Beck, who's a Zen teacher from the West Coast, describes a way that a French psychiatrist who had been really terribly injured in an accident and had a couple of years where all he could do was lie in bed. So he tried to solve the human dilemma by just lying there and really deeply reflecting, delving into all the grief and loss and pain and fear in his body. And what he came up with was that he described this clutch that we're calling fear as this effort to protect ourselves as a spasm. And he called the ceaseless chatter of our inner dialogue the imaginary film. And he realized that the spasm is on the road to Satori. What that means is that the very nature of the clutch is with attention. If we bring attention, openness, presence to that clutch, it's a gateway to total freedom. This is very much in line with the Tibetan tradition too. If we open to where the deepest clutch of selfing is, that very openness liberates us. So this is how he put it. He said, one can indeed say that what should be perceived under the imaginary film, that's our thinking, is a certain profound sensation of cramp, of a paralyzing grip, of a mobilizing cold, and that it is on this hard couch, immobile and cold, that our attention should remain and rest, as though we tranquilly stretched out our body on a hard but friendly rock that was exactly molded to our form. So there's this clutch, and it's as if we tranquilly stretched out our body on a hard but friendly rock that was exactly molded to our form. This is a description of not resisting, not controlling. It's exactly counter to our entire programming to try to get away from what's unpleasant, to lie down on the icy couch. Sometimes it's described as leaning into fear. Leaning in, meaning surrendering all the resistance. A woman that I was working with some years ago, a couple of years ago, was a meditator, and she came to me because right after she had had a terrible breakup, a breakup that really just was crushing. And she came to me when she was beginning to see somebody new, and that person she was seeing was waffling. And the waffling set off a level of abandonment issues. Her father had left her mother and left the home when they were four. And she was terrified. It wasn't just like, oh, maybe this relationship won't work. It was terror for her. So we did a session together. And the first part of the session, when she said, okay, there's terror here, I didn't say, okay, breathe in and open to that terror, sit down on the icy couch, lie down. You know, it wasn't like that. I first, you know, said, let's just sense that there's like a park bench here and just let the fear be right next to you. But let's just know that I'm right here and sense where we are, you know, sense the space of the room, and she could hear birds outside and sense sky. So I first had her connect with what was right here and bigger, and the fear was right there. And then I said, okay, begin to just sense its presence here. Just take some time to sense the presence. And you might ask that fear, just to feel it kind of here, what it most really wants from you. What does it need from you right now? This was an important question, because this is her beginning to shift her relationship. What does that fear want from you? And she was quiet for a moment, and her response was, it wants me to let it be okay that it's here. In other words, it wants me to just accept that it's here, not to hate it or push it away. And then when she kept staying with, you know, I said, so anything else? She said, it just wants me to be, pay attention, you know, be here. That's when we began to, she put her hand on her heart, and as James described last night, a hand on the cheek or the heart is a sense of a larger sense of our being offering presence. In other words, in the moment that you put your hand on your own heart or your own cheek, rather than being identified with the fear, there's an opening into that mindfulness and heartfulness that's aware of the fear, enlarging the sense of being. So she started breathing with the fear. It was no longer over there. It was a current in her. She was breathing with it. And it was very scary for her. And periodically she had her eyes closed, but she'd open her eyes to remember I was there and to sense the room and that she was here. But she was offering it care. And what opened up, she said, underneath that fear was an excruciating loneliness. And, you know, this was about abandonment. So underneath that fear was this excruciating loneliness what she was believing about herself was that she wasn't lovable and that it was going to be played out again and she was going to be left. real loneliness. And so she just kept doing the practice that we're doing here, which is really to notice what's happening. Okay, loneliness, to breathe with it and to really just let it be there, not do anything to it, just let it be there. And the more she could let it be there, she found that she was in some way saying, I'm here for you, I'm here for you. And then she looked up and she said, it's not like I'm here, it's just love is here, love is here. Now I want to slow down again because there's a shift there. That we think we're putting a hand on our own cheek or a hand on our heart and saying, okay, I'm here with this fear, I'm here with this pain. But the more we are present and allowing, that I starts dissolving and there's just here-ness. This is the kind of crux of what the Buddha described as a dissolving of the small self-identity and opening, and it comes when there's presence and care. I shared this with her, and I want to share it with you. It's one of my favorite poems by Hafiz. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you as few human or even divine ingredients can. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need of God absolutely clear. So in maybe a more Buddhist perspective, God is really that loving presence that's always here, but when we're feeling separate, we experience an incredible longing or an incredible pain of separation. For this woman, staying with opened her into that loneliness and into the longing and into the actual presence itself. There's a term in the Tibetan tradition that I find really alive, which is Dakini bliss. And Dakinis are deities that embody compassion. And that the bliss is, it's this pathway of realization that I'm really talking about here, whereby bringing this incredibly full, kind presence to what's really difficult, we relax open into being that presence. There's a kind of a bliss that comes because we realize, oh, I'm that. The very thing I'm wanting, the very thing I thought was missing is what I am. But the pathway is in this very courageous kind of staying. Now, it's important to know that if we're really caught in the trance of fear, it's very hard to even offer care because our whole biochemistry is tight and knotted. So it's not always possible to say, okay, I'm here for myself, and oh, there's just here-ness, there's just awareness. So I want to take this a step further and say that there are times that we feel so caught and so afraid that we can't directly take refuge in the Dharma. We can't directly open to the waves. We can't say yes right away. And to have this idea like we're supposed to say yes is another trip we can lay on ourselves. Like sometimes it feels like too much. Do you know what I mean? Like just too much to open to. And with Ajahn Chah, and part of what I loved about the story was that he was opening to what was there, but his mind kind of turned towards something larger. He remembered that, wait a minute, this feeling, this body, these perceptions aren't self, there's something larger, there's awareness. He took refuge in something larger. We can't be with the waves unless there's some sense of a something larger. I use the metaphor a lot of that we're an ocean with waves moving through, and that if we can remember we're the ocean, there's room for the waves. And when we're suffering, the trance is we have contracted to hitch our identity to the waves. We can't be with the waves if we're so hitched that we're totally forgetting the ocean. We need some way of remembering, I'm not these waves. We can either do it the way Ajahn Chah did it with, which is sometimes called the negativa, where we're saying, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this, nyet, nyet. Or it can be a kind of calling on what we are, something larger. In other words, those are the two different ways back to empty, open awareness. Rumi describes it in the second way, and I'll just a very brief verse. When water gets caught in habitual whirlpools, dig a way out through the bottom to the ocean. There is a secret medicine given only to those who hurt so hard they can't hope. There's a secret medicine given only to those who hurt so hard they can't hope. The hopers would feel slighted if they knew. Look as long as you can at the friend you love, no matter whether that friend is moving away from you or coming back toward you. Look as long as you can at the friend you love, no matter whether that friend is moving away from you or coming back to you. So what does that mean? Again, the trance is that we've forgotten something. When we're in fear, we are believing in separateness. We're forgetting. So how do we look as long as we can at the friend we love? My understanding is that in some way we intuit loving presence that suffuses this universe and is what we are, and that when we're caught in fear, in addition to being with the waves of fear, that there can be an inclining the mind, a remembering, an intention to call on that loving presence. It's not a running away. It's actually the impulse of awareness to bring us back home to itself. I'll give you an example from my own experience in recent months. As I've shared with many of you, that I've gone through a lot of cycles of sickness, and actually this cold is low key. This is just a blip. I mean, it's really a very obvious external one. But I've gone through stuff where I just haven't known what's going on, and I've been through many tests and this doctor and that, and it's been a really amazing Dharma practice because the physical discomfort has not been a big deal. I mean, it's been unpleasant. But what's really the big deal and where the suffering is the stories that run around it. And the stories are, I'm going to lose what I love. I'm going to not be able to do what I love doing. I'm going to let people down. There's a sense of if I get sick, I'll be in a kind of aversive state, and then I will not be an open-hearted, compassionate, loving, giving person. I'll be small-minded and contracted and, you know, that kind of thing. So the sense of not being who I want to be, a lot of fear. So my practice has gotten very, very simple, much in the way I'm talking about tonight, where I'll notice, okay, what am I believing? I'm believing that I'm believing in a self going into a future where there's loss. There's a map in my mind of a self going into a future where there's loss, and the loss is going to come because I'm going to let people down and not be able to do what I want to do. And then loss of this body and loss of this life. So I'll see those thoughts and I'll say, okay, here, right here. And then breathe with what's right here. And what's right here is all the flavors of that fear in my body, very unpleasant. So I often also put my hand on my own heart. I actually sit a lot when it's strong like this. And there's a sense of, again, a self offering a self presence and comfort. I'll sometimes offer a message. Because again, it's establishing a different relationship with the fear. Rather than go away, I don't like you, this is bad, something's wrong with me, it's okay, I'm here. And I heard a story about a Hawaiian healer, and his whole practice was with whatever came up in him that was difficult, including his awareness of what was difficult for another person. He'd feel in his body and he'd say, I'm sorry, I love you. And he'd say it over and over again, I'm sorry, I love you. And the I'm sorry wasn't like, you've done something wrong or I've done something wrong. It was more, I care about this. I'm sorry, I care about this suffering. And I love you is this absolute embrace of presence. So I would, as a way to deepen that presence, to release the armoring, to disarm the self, I'm sorry, I love you. But often the fear is so existential, it's such a deep clutch, that with a little bit of softening, I'd sense the possibility of love, and that's when I'd actually pray. And I do pray. I call on the beloved, which, whether it's, you know, the term is Kuan Yin or the Bodhisattva of compassion, calling in some way on the loving presence that I intuit is here but might feel separate from in the moment. And it, for me, it's kind of a sense like this field of luminosity and warmth and love. So that I actually imagine and sense that surrounding me and holding me, so that I can take the fear, and it's almost like I'm just so open to it that I can surrender it into that field. Surrender the fear into the beloved. It's not a pushing away. You can't surrender something you don't feel fully. And the word surrender feels accurate to me because it's a complete release of any control. It's a feeling fully what's here. It's like breathing and totally being touched by what's here, but absolutely letting it go into the larger belonging. It's like a river releasing itself into the ocean. Havis again. Ask the friend for love. Ask him again, for I have learned that every heart will get what it prays for most. Ask the friend for love. Ask him again, for I've learned that every heart will get what it prays for most. When we're stuck in fear, we're caught in an idea and a sense of a self that's separate. And yet, because the truth is we are a loving presence, there's some intuition of that, and that's the place the prayer comes from. It's not like we're trying to grab onto something to say of our life. It's like there's this deep longing that intuits what we are, and prayer is this bridge between longing and belonging. If the prayer comes from a deep place of presence, it actually carries us back home to what we are. So for me, when I go through those phases of all the sickness brings up the fear, and I see the beliefs, and I open to what's there, and there's some presence with it, and calling on loving presence, and that surrendering. What happens next is there's this, some sort of an inquiry in me, and really, who's surrendering, and what am I surrendering into? There's some kind of inquiry into what's really happening. And it's so clear that there's no self-surrendering fear. And there's no bodhisattva out there receiving what's being surrendered. It's just waves of fear being realized, loved by an ocean of presence. So I share this with you because really fear becomes a portal to selflessness, to really recognizing it's empty. And that emptiness is boundless and loving. And we can't realize that as what we are unless we're willing to open to that clench, which is in every human body mind. For some, opening to the clench is harder, and that's because there's been more severed belonging. Again, I'll read Havis because he's really so good on this. He says, "How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened." So I've talked about the refuges, two of them, that when this humanness arises, that one of our refuges is in the Dharma, in the truth of what's happening, to recognize it and to open to it without any resistance, to not control it. That we can't do it unless there's some sufficient sense of safety, of openness. Full presence means contacting, seeing what's here, but also a quality of openness and warmth. That refuge in the Buddha, it could be in the historical Buddha, it could be in awareness itself, it could be in seeing the emptiness, it could be in calling on the beloved. But in some way, a remembering, a reconnecting with that vastness and that truth of what we are. The third refuge, which I'll only mention briefly since I'm pretty out of time right now, is refuge in the Sangha. And in a way, I'm sorry I didn't make more time for it, because one of the biggest delusions is that we're the separate self on this path trying to get to freedom, working with our fear, making a spiritual muscle so that we can get to the finish line, enlightenment. And it's got more selfing to it. We can't do this without each other. We were wounded in relationship and we healed by remembering, reconnecting with this field of togetherness. And whether it's with one person that we trust, sees, and loves us, or whether it's with a Sangha that's holding a space that's really deeply honoring and caring, or whether it's with somebody who's no longer alive, but we sense the truth of their care, something that reminds us that we're not alone, that it's not a separate self doing it, to wake up. So I'd like to close with a brief meditation. And even though I've been talking about fear, I could be talking about any of the expressions of that clench of selfing. Could be anger, grief, depression. But you might sense if there's anything from today or in recent times that is wanting your attention, where you sense that some sort of a habit of this clutch and the kind of wanting to get away, wanting to run away from it. Something you don't like that's going on inside, where there's a sense of something's wrong. And take a few moments just to recognize whatever's true about this. Just a real honesty of the kind of beliefs that are floating around, the stories. What am I believing? When caught in that smallness, when there's a shrinking, what's the belief? What's the experience in the body? Even if you have no content going on right now, just to sense the possibility of fully being here with just how it is. So you might be feeling an experience of fear or hurt, or maybe you're in a very quiet, open place. To recognize and allow what's happening, completely saying yes, no resistance. And if it feels difficult, to sense what's larger, what has room, you might, as I did, call on the beloved in some way. Just with sincerity, just call on loving presence. Even if you have no idea what that means, there's some intuition of loving presence. Look towards the friend, as Rumi says, and sense the space, the openness that has room for whatever waves are moving through. What happens if there's absolutely no controlling? Just being the presence. Being that empty heart, that openness. When we know we're the ocean, we're not afraid of the waves. When we know we're the ocean, we're not afraid of the waves. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Move outside the tangle of fear thinking. Live in silence. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. So thank you for your presence here tonight. And we have a little time for walking, as in about 25 minutes almost. And then we'll come back for our last sit together. Okay, thank you.